Okay. Thank you again for the invitation to speak. I'd like to thank the organizers and also the audience, the participants, for being here. I'm going to talk about work which has appeared in a preprint with my co-authors, Moto Fukuda and David Moser, also from Northeastern University. The content of the paper is the results of our reading and working through Matt Hastings' paper, where he proves the existence of counterexamples to the additivity conjectures. The content of his paper is that he finally disproved the long-standing conjecture that channel capacity is additive. His paper is on the archive and has since appeared in Nature, I think. So I'm going to go through the results that we pulled out of his paper and show you what we're able to show, and hopefully give you an idea of the ideas that are in his proof. So the background again is concerned with quantum channels. So a quantum channel is a completely positive trace-preserving map on matrix algebras. So every such map has a Krauss representation in this form, which is the sum of conjugations by collections of matrices that satisfy a normalization condition that I've written down there. So phi is a map between finite-dimensional matrix algebras. They don't have to be the same dimensions. The quantity of interest I'm going to focus on is this number associated with the channel, which is called the minimal output entropy. And that's the smallest value of the von Neumann entropy of an output state from the channel. So these rows are states, which means that they're self-adjoint positive semi-definite and have trace 1. And S then is the von Neumann entropy, which is minus trace of rho log rho. So the question is, what's the smallest value of the output entropy that you can attain using this the channel phi? So in some way, this is a measure of the noisiness of the channel, because a state has entropy 0 if and only if it's a pure state, and the larger the entropy, the more mixed the state. So what this is really saying is, what's the least noisy output state that you can get from the channel? And that's sort of a measure of the noisiness of the channel phi. Okay, so if you take a tensor product of two channels, you again get a channel. You again get a completely positive and trace-preserving map. So you can again calculate the minimal output entropy. That's S min. And then the additivity conjecture for S min says that should be equal to the sum of the minimal output entropies for the two channels, phi and omega. Okay. And it's obvious that the left-hand side is less than or equal to this, because you can achieve this value here by evaluating this channel on product states. So the question is whether if you evaluate it on entangled states, you get something smaller. So the question is really whether there are channels for which you get strict inequality here. And the background to this really is that it was an outgrowth of the conjecture that the Hollowell capacity is additive for product channels. That itself was an outgrowth of the idea that there was a single letter formula for the channel, the classical capacity of a quantum channel, which was just the Hollowell capacity. So this was originally sort of an independent conjecture, which looked like an easier one. And then in 2004, Shor proved that in fact this conjecture is equivalent to the additivity of the Hollowell capacity. So here I'm just going to concentrate on this conjecture here. that. Okay, so the analysis that I'm going to present makes use of the Stein spring representation of the quantum channel. And the Stein spring representation says that every channel can be written in this form here, where the Krauss matrices that I wrote down before are sort of bundled into a matrix here, a W, which now maps from this input space CS into a bipartite space CD tensor CN, D with the number of Krauss operators. So you just sort of build a column matrix by putting the Krauss operators in. And then you get a bigger matrix there and the adjoint. And then the normalization condition for the Krauss operator says it's a partial isometry. So W star W is the identity. And then by taking the trace over the blocks, which are labeling the Krauss matrices, you recover the other form. So this is a nice way of thinking about it, because you sort of break it up into two steps, where first you have a partial isometry that maps the input states into a bipartite space, and then you take a partial trace to get back the channel phi. This isn't a unique representation. There are many partial isometries that which will do it, but if you fix this particular partial isometry W, remember this matrix W rho W star is now in this on this bipartite space. So instead of tracing over the first part, you can trace over the second part, and if you do that, you get another channel which I've called phi c, which is the conjugate or complementary channel. And so now there's a one-to-one correspondence between these partial isometries W and the pair of channels phi and phi c, and that turns out to be somehow the right way to think about it. So instead of thinking about channels phi, you think of a pair of channels phi and phi c, and then that's equivalent to thinking about a partial isometry. Okay. So, just to go back to the minimal entropy question again, which is what we're interested in, what that means in terms of this partial isometry W. If we have a bipartite state in CD tensor CN psi, then the entanglement of that state is defined to be the entropy of its reduced density matrix. So this is a general notion. Since it's a pure state, it doesn't matter whether you trace on the first or the second factor. You get a matrix with the same spectrum, so the entropy is the same. And that's defined to be the entanglement of the state psi. And that's zero if and only if it's a product state. Okay, so it's telling you something about how entangled a state is. Okay, so building on this idea, then, you can define the entanglement of a subspace of CD sensor CN to be the minimum entanglement among all the states in the subspace. And again, that will be zero if and only if the subspace contained the product state. So if we consider a partial isometry W, as we are doing for a channel, which maps some input space CS into the bipartite space, then the entanglement of W is defined to be this entanglement of the subspace, which is its range. So you look at the infimum over all input states of the entropy of the reduced density matrix of the image of phi under the partial isometry. So you identify the partial isometry with the subspace that it maps into, and then you say, what's the minimal entropy? What's the minimal entanglement of the state in the subspace? And that's the entanglement of the partial isometry. Okay, and again, this is zero if and only if the range of W contains a product state. Okay, and so if you think of that in terms of the channel phi, then this operation here is exactly applying the map the channel phi to the input state. Got too many phis there, but there it goes. And so the entropy of that is the same as the entropy of this. And you can take the trace over the first factor, and that gives you phi c. So this entanglement of W is the same as the minimal output entropy of phi, and the same as the minimal output entropy of phi c. Okay. So we're interested in these guys here, so it's the same as talking about E of W. Okay, so in the pursuit of this general question of the additivity conjecture, what we're interested in for counterexamples is sort of worst-case analysis for these guys here. So we're interested in sort of worst-case analysis for the entanglement of the partial isometries. So that's what I'm defining here then. This is the maximum that you can achieve for the entanglement of a partial isometry from CS into CD tensor CN. And because I'm looking at this soup over everything conceivable, the only thing it depends on is the dimensions of the spaces. Okay. So associated with an input space and bipartite space dimensions D and N, we've got a number here which is the maximal entanglement that you can achieve. So as I'll show a little bit later, the additivity question can be reformulated as a question about this thing here. Okay, so what's known about this this entanglement here? Well, the first result that I know about is by Patrick Hayden, Debbie Long, and Andreas Winter in 2006, who obtained the following lower bound. D is bigger, is less than or equal to N. And then this is bounded below by the following. You get a log D. So you're mapping into a bipartite space. So D is the smaller of the dimensions. So this is sort of the biggest it could possibly be is the log of D. So it gives a bound by saying how much smaller than the log of D is it. And there's two factors. One is D over N here with a constant. And the other is this factor. You can ignore the plus one. It's just really S over DN to the 2/5 times the log of D. Okay. And again, S is the dimension of the input space, and N is output, and D is environment. Or you can switch the role of the output and the environment by because they really play a symmetric role. Okay. So that's the bound which they obtain. And this played a role then in the counterexamples to multiplicativity of the P norm, which Andreas and Patrick then were able to prove. Okay, so the results that come out of Hastings' work can also be formulated in this way as a bound on E max. And one of the differences is that the method of proof requires that the dimensions become sufficiently large. It sort of makes use of some asymptotics, so you need the dimensions to be big. So the input dimension S and the output dimension N need to be sufficiently large. Again, D is less than or equal to N. So we're mapping from an input space S into a bipartite space CD tensor CN, and D is a smaller one. And then S and N are both large. So basically it says that this max is bounded below, again, by log D. And now we have some parameter H, which you can choose as long as it's sufficiently large. And then we have the same factor S over ND, but now we have a power of 1 here. Okay, so in the previous, should have frozen that. In the previous one, it comes into the power of 2/5, and here we have a power of 1. And that somehow is essential for the conclusions of Hastings' work. The input dimension needs to scale with the output dimension. This is just basically saying that S is proportional to N. And then N needs to be sufficiently large. Okay. So, this result is valid as long as the output dimension is sufficiently large and the input dimension needs to be proportional to N. You can also prove a similar bound by having S scale as a fractional power of N as long as the fraction isn't too small. So this number H min that appears here is sort of related to a large deviation rate for the entropy of a random matrix, so you have an explicit expression, but it's sufficient to note that there's an upper bound for it which doesn't depend on the dimensions. So you can sort of figure out what that is. So just to compare the bounds, the Hayden Long Winter bound holds for all dimensions, while for the Hastings bound, the proof requires that dimensions are sufficiently large with a fixed ratio of S to N. And in terms of the asymptotics, the HLW bound again behaves like this, S over N D to the 2/5, whereas the Hastings bound behaves like S over N D. And so the Hastings bound is sharper in the regime where S is very much less than N D. And so in particular, if you take the input space to be this S to be equal to N, this is saying that when D is very much bigger than 1, you get a sharper bound from this. Okay, so to see the relation to the additivity question now, let me go back to the partial isometries. If we take the complex conjugate of the matrix W that's used to define phi, then we get another channel, phi bar, which is defined by this formula here. And this has a conjugate channel also, phi bar C, which is defined in the same way. And the entanglement of W and W bar are the same, and the minimal output entropies of all these things are the same. Okay. So, so in order to find the counterexamples to additivity, Hastings considers product channels of the form phi tensor phi bar, these are the channels which give the violations of additivity. So that requires getting an upper bound on the minimal output entropy of phi tensor phi bar. So this is the upper bound here. P is this ratio that appeared in both the both the theorems, S over dN. So that's less than or equal to 1. Then in addition, we need S D over N bigger than or equal to 1. And in that case, we have an upper bound which says that the minimal output entropy is bounded by this binary entropy of P, and then we get this factor with basically a log of D squared. Okay, so this is like 2 log D here, basically. And that's the minus something small. And so that's what we need to get, okay? So, I'll show where that comes from, but let's look at the violations of additivity. So we look at this channel, phi tensor phi bar, and the violation of additivity is the amount by which this sum is bigger than this. Okay, so and these are equal, so that's the same as just saying the amount by which twice this is bigger than this. So if we go back to the Hastings result, then we know that if we take let's take S equal to N for simplicity, so that goes out. So the Hastings bound says that the minimal, you can find a phi for which the minimal output entropy is bigger than log D minus H over D. And H you can choose, as long as you make H sufficiently large, just order 1, then you can find a channel that satisfies this. So if you substitute this into the bound here, this is bigger than or equal to twice log D minus twice H over D. And then for this, we use the bound over here, which gives us this. And now you can throw away things pretty much. You can, that factor there, you can just bound by minus P, so put that in there. D squared minus 1 make it into a D squared. Okay. And then you can combine this term and this term, because this is a 2 log D as well, and this, so you sort of end up with a P log D. Put that over there. So combining those two terms, you just get a 2 P log D, and then you have a P log P left over, minus twice H over D, and a minus P. And P is S over ND, but S equals N, so that's equal to 1 over D. So you put that in there, and this becomes this factor out of 1 over D, and you get a factor of log D minus 2H minus 1. Okay? So now we want this to be positive. Okay, well, if you take D bigger than E to the 2H plus 1, then you get a positive entropy. Okay? And that proves the existence of a channel which violates the additivity conjecture. Okay, so Okay, so I'm going to talk about the proof of that, but let me just make a few further remarks about it first. Okay, first thing is that this is an existence proof, and as yet there are no known examples of channels which actually violate additivity. So the method of proof not only shows the existence of such a channel, but it's a probabilistic argument, and a probabilistic argument either shows you that something's impossible or it always happens. So in this case, it always happens. So as n goes to infinity, the probability that a randomly chosen channel satisfies this bound approach is 1. Okay, so it says that as n goes to infinity, as long as d is sufficiently large, if you just randomly pick a channel, then it's going to violate additivity. But the interesting thing as well is that the size of the violation, as you increase d, you can have a 1 over d in front of it, so the size of the violation goes to 0. So it's an interesting question to see what the, you know, where does it start and stuff like that. So to find d min to be the smallest value of the dimension d for which you get a violation of additivity. So the sum n, sum s, and sum channel phi, so that's positive. The same for n min. How big does that have to be? And let's say that delta s max is the biggest violation. Okay. So what's the typical size of those? Okay, so we can prove some bounds on those. D min, which is the dimension of the environment that you need, can be less than basically this number here, which looks big, but if you put it in terms of qubits, it's okay, 15 qubits and you get a violation, right? N min is the dimension of the input or the output space, so that has to be at least so we have an upper bound for that also. Maybe the strangest thing is this here. This is the biggest bound. This is the biggest violation that we were able to construct using this proof. And as I said, you know, as d gets larger, the violation gets even smaller. So I don't know. I mean, whether this is an artifact of the proof or not, I don't know. But what the proof indicates is that the additivity violation is, you know, as you increase the dimension, you sort of get a bump there, and then it goes away again as the dimensions get larger. Okay. Is that real or not? That's a nice question. I don't know the answer. These bounds are surely not optimal. Yeah. Right. Okay. So these bounds here were attained for the random unitary channels, which are these particular ones. This is the form of channel that Hastings used in his original proof. And for this particular class of channels, we find the biggest violations. Okay. The what I described at the start is true for arbitrary channels, but for this particular class, you seem to get better bounds. Again, I don't know why. Okay. So let's look at the proofs. The simpler proof is the upper bound for the minimal output entropy of phi tensor phi bar. You use a Krauss representation. We've got a Krauss representation for phi. We don't know anything about the A's. Okay, so let's just put them in and see what happens. This is the maximally entangled state. So if you put in the Krauss representations for phi and phi bar, this is the complex conjugate, so you get this here. And then we got this fact that if you have a matrix tensor, the complex conjugate of the maximally entangled state, you can pull that over and it becomes A star. So you get A star times the identity. And because the dimensions are different, you get a correction factor here. So if you apply that to the terms with I equals J, then you get this guy here. And then everything else is here. So let's just jump to the end point here. If you take this first term here, and if you take the inner product with the maximally entangled state, then you get a lower bound for that here, and that leads to this bound here. So that says that if you apply phi tensor phi bar to the maximally entangled state, you get an output state whose inner product with this maximally entangled state is at least S over dn. This is a positive operator, so if you forget about that, you still have a lower bound. So this says that one of the eigenvalues of that state is larger than or equal to S over dn. And that's the whole thing then. The rank is d squared, so you have at most d squared minus 1 other non-zero eigenvalues. And the entropy is biggest when you just make those all equal. And if you put that in, then you get this bound here. Okay. So that's pretty easy. And again, it holds for a general channel phi. Okay. So in his paper, Hastings proved the existence of random unitary channels which violate the additivity conjecture. And he did this by introducing a probability measure on the space of all the random unitary channels, and then proving that there was a non-zero probability that a randomly selected channel will violate additivity as long as the dimensions are sufficiently large. And again, his proof in fact shows that the probability approaches 1 and then goes to infinity. His methods can be extended almost without change to the class of all channels, and the result is proved by using a probability measure on the partial isometries. Okay, so again, every channel or pair of channels, phi and phi complement, is equivalent to a partial isometry. So you just put a probability measure on the partial isometries, and then that gives you a probability measure on the space of channels. And that's easily done because every partial isometry from CS into CD tensor CN can be written as a unitary times a fixed one. And so if you make this a random unitary, then this is a random partial isometry. Okay. And that's the probability measure, the partial isometries. And recall, what we want to do is to show the existence of a partial isometry for which this entanglement is bigger than log d minus a constant times s over nd. And the idea, again, is to prove that with a positive probability, this bound will be satisfied by a randomly selected one. Okay, so it's convenient to use the language both of partial isometries and of channels. So just to remind you again, W maps CS into CD tensor CN. And if you apply that partial isometry of state and take the trace over this factor, you get phi. And if you take the trace over that factor, you get phi C. So I'll be using the notation of both of those. Okay. So I'm not going to go through the details of the proof because I think it's more illuminating maybe just to try to say what are the main ideas. So that's what I'm going to do. And I've distilled those down to what I call three important properties of these random channels. And they're generic in the sense that with high probability they hold for a randomly selected channel. So just so that I don't have to keep writing stuff down, this is the sort of target that we want to beat. So if the entropy is larger than this, we'll say that the entropy of rho is large, otherwise the entropy is small. Okay. So, and our goal again is to prove the existence of a randomly selected partial isometry such that the entropy of this output is large for all input states. For all input states, that's the key. Okay. So property one. Okay. So property one says that if you fix an input state and a randomly selected channel phi, then the output state of the complementary channel is very likely to be concentrated near the maximally mixed state. So in the infinity norm, the distance between the output of this complementary channel and the totally mixed state, which is just the identity matrix times 1 over g, this will be small in this sense here. Now, n is the dimension of the output space, which is going to be very large. So log n over n is going to be very small. So this is saying that if you fix the input state and then just randomly select the channel phi, then with a very high probability, this output state here, which is a mixed state, is going to be very close to the maximally mixed state. And that's basically because n is going to be very large, so you're taking a random subspace in a bipartite space, CD tensor CN, you're tracing over the big one, the big factor, so with a very high probability, what's left over in the small factor is just completely mixed. Okay, you've thrown away all the information. Phi will be very close to a projection onto a subspace of dimension d. So it's just easier to work with phi c instead of with the complementary channel phi. Okay, so the spectrum of phi, the spectrum of the channel phi applied to this input state will be the same as the spectrum of phi c applied to the input state. Okay, so this is saying something about the spectrum. It's saying all the eigenvalues are very close to 1 over z. And for the channel phi, it says that the first d eigenvalues will be very close to 1 over d, and then the rest will be very close to 0. Okay. But it's just easier to work with this one here instead of having a lot of zeros that don't play any role. So again, because all these eigenvalues are very close to 1 over d, the entropy is going to be very close to the maximum log d, and thus it's going to be a large entropy, which is going to be fine for us. We want to show that if we randomly pick a channel and apply it to any input state, then the output will have large entropy. So this says that if you fix an input state and you randomly select a channel, then that'll be true with a high probability. And in fact, I mean, if it's true for one state, then it's true for a lot of states. And in fact, you can easily show that it'll be true for at least half of the input states. Okay, so if you sort of if you randomly pick an input state and you randomly pick a channel, then with a high probability this bound is going to be satisfied, and you can get enough control on that, then you can actually say that with probably a half, it's going to be true for any input state. So for at least half of the input states, this randomly selected channel is going to map them all into something very close to this. Okay, so I'm going to draw a picture here, because so it says that if we take the input states, which are in this S-dimensional space, and we apply a randomly chosen channel, then it's going to map at least half the input states into a small neighborhood of the Toltymax. Okay, so this is our output space here. Then this is the totally mixed state, 1 over d times the identity, phi c. Then it's going to map at least half the input states into a very small neighborhood here. Because I want to draw it simply, I've shaded in half of the sphere, but the input states that map there, of course, are just randomly distributed over the sphere. Not saying anything about where they are here, but it's saying that at least half of them here will go into here. Okay. Okay, so property two is I think the most interesting, and maybe the one that will bear the most attention when you go back. You know, I urge you to go and read this paper and understand what he says, but I think that this is really an interesting idea. So half the input states are grand. Okay, they get mapped into a small ball with high entropy. We don't have to worry about them. But it's the other states that might cause problems. Okay, so the point is that there might be some other state out here which gets mapped out to something here with low entropy, and then we don't get our bound. Okay, so what this says is that this output is sticky in some way. You imagine pulling this thing out, then it has to pull out a tail along with it. So there's a sort of tube of output states which connect the image of any state back into this ball again. Okay, and if there's some other state out here, then it also has to be connected back sort of by a tube to this state here. Okay, now the way that Okay, so that's what I call stickiness, all right, just to give it a name. Imagine pulling it out, it's like toppy or something, there's got to be a tail connecting it back in. And what that means is that you can't have an isolated state of low entropy in the image of the map. Okay, if there's a state of low entropy here, then there's a sort of a penalty or a price, which is that there's this tube that connects it back into here. And so that tube has a certain weight associated with it, and that's the key that let you handle it. Okay, now how would you prove something like this? Well, the way that a similar result was proved, maybe if I can paraphrase back in the Hayden, Lung, and Winter paper, is that you carve up the input space here And you prove a bound on a discrete set of points, and then you use regularity of the entropy function and the Lipschitz estimate to say that if you know the entropy of a state here, then the entropy of the neighborhood there can't be too different from it. And then you get the control over there. A natural thing to do, okay? So Hastings is really doing something different. He's carving up the image of the map phi. He's saying that if you have a low entropy output state here, then what he's going to do is actually he just takes half this tube here, and he says, I'm just going to look at half that tube there and prove that that has to have a certain weight associated with it. The states that are in there don't come from a neighborhood of this, or they needn't come from a neighborhood. They're just randomly distributed over the sphere here. So you're not carving up this, you're not carving up the domain of phi. You're carving up the range instead, and that's somehow what makes it work. And I think that's really the essential difference, which makes this work. And gives a better bound than was known in the previous case. Okay, so just to make this more precise, if we have an output state rho, this L of rho is just the line segment that connects it down into the maximally mixed state. So L is just the straight line that goes down here, or actually just half this line segment. So there's just the line segment there, and then we thicken that out to make a tube. So we take all states whose distance from that line is again bounded by this factor of, which is kind of the radius of this tube here, but a bit larger by a factor of d. Okay, so we take a line segment there and we thicken it out and we get a tube, and that's what this tail is where the price is paid, and then so the estimate is that that a certain fraction of the input states, namely this fraction, must get mapped into that tube. Okay, so it says that for any state which is in the output of phi, the fraction of input states that get mapped into that tube is at least this factor here, beta times 2 to the minus s, and s is the dimension of the input space. Okay, so that's saying what the weight of that tube is there, and it looks bad because it's exponentially small, but it turns out that it's enough. Okay. Okay, and again, blah, 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 just to say, make the same point again. Okay, the stickiness that wherever it is, no matter how far out it is, there's this tail of a certain fraction of states have to go in there. Okay, so last property, 3. Okay, so this, I know property 1 and property 3 are sort of things you would think of maybe if you're doing it, you know, okay, you know, using a probability argument, you think of it in this. Property 2, I think is the really amazing part of it. So, but in property 3 is the observation that if you randomly select a partial isometry W, then randomly select an input state, what's going to happen to it? It's going to get mapped into something here, psi, which is just a random state in CD tensor CN. Okay, because U is a random unit tree, so you apply that to something, you're going to get a random state. So, looking at this here, then the output of the channel is going to be the reduced density matrix of a random bipartite state, and that's been very well studied. And the density of that is known explicitly. So, in particular, you can obtain very precise large deviation rate estimates as n goes to infinity. So you can prove an estimate like this, that the probability that the entropy of a randomly selected bipartite state is less than, is small, this is what I'm calling small here, is less than our desired bound log d minus h over d, is bounded by something which is exponentially small in n. Okay, we've got a correction factor here, but this is the dominant for large n. And md of h is a large deviation rate for this probability measure. And all we need to know about it is that it goes to infinity as h goes to infinity, uniformly in d. So that's what controls it there. Okay. Okay. So the idea now is to put these together to prove the results. So I'm just going to go through that in kind of a mime fashion. Say that V is the set of bad partial isometries. So the bad ones are the ones where the entanglement is not as large as we'd like. In other words, it's less than log d minus h over d. So we want to show that this has probability less than 1. And in fact, we'll show that it goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. So the bad ones have probabilities. Okay, so because it's a bad one, that means that there must be an output state which has low entropy, okay, because this is kind of the smallest entropy of an output state, so there must be something that satisfies this bound here. The entropy of the output state is small. Okay, so just to give it a name, I call it rho W. So the idea now is to consider a joint event where you randomly select a partial isometry W and you randomly select an input state phi. The partial isometry is going to be one of the bad ones that doesn't do what we want, so the output entropy is small. And then the input state phi is chosen to be one of the ones that gets mapped into, well, remember we have a bad output state rho W, so we just say let's get mapped into the tube of that thing. And the tube again is this little segment here. So again we randomly pick a partial isometry, randomly pick a channel, and then we pick an input state which goes into here, and we know that those things exist because that's the stickiness argument. So we choose one of those in there. Okay. Then for property two, which is the stickiness argument, the probability of this event, I can sort of do a conditional probability here, say probability of the W's in B, then the conditional probability, given W's in B, that we randomly choose this thing in the tube, and property two says that probability there is bounded below by this factor, beta 2 to the minus n. I had 2 to the minus s, but I'm taking s equal to n. Okay, s is the input dimension. So this probability we know is bounded below by this. So now we get this bound here. It's beta 2 to the minus n times the probability of B. B is the bad set, so we want to show this is small. Okay? So we now have a lower bound for this event in terms of the probability of the bad set. Okay, so the idea now is to get an upper bound using property 3. And we get that pretty easily because we can make this bigger if we just say, well, instead of caring about that being the bad set and this being the tube, let's just say that the entropy of this thing should be small, because that's certainly true here. I'm sort of choosing it so that it's in this tube, and these things all have small entropy. So if I just say I'm going to randomly pick a W and a phi such that the output state has that small entropy, that certainly includes all of those, so we've got an upper bound. But now here, I'm just randomly picking a bipartite state psi. Okay, if I randomly pick W and phi, say something about the entropy of the output, that's the same as just the question about a random bipartite state. And this is exactly what I know how to bound. This is bounded by this factor here. Okay? So if I put that lower bound together with the upper bound, divide across by this factor, I get this estimate here. And you can see that the 2 to the minus n is giving me this growth, but the rate function is giving me the decay, and this wins as long as h is sufficiently large, which was the statement, okay? So, and that'll kill this off and take care of this. So as n goes to infinity, then the probability becomes less than 1. Okay. So that's the proof. I mean that's the structure of the proof, and you need to do estimates and inequalities to make it work. But that's how it flows. However, I would say that it's quite delicate in the sense that you're sort of balancing these terms, which are of the same order, and it works. But somehow you don't know that until you get to the end. So it's a different sort of proof than I'm accustomed to doing. Okay, because you're sort of working it, and then it's only when you get to the end that you know if it works or not. So, I don't know. It's pretty amazing. However, the result is clear, and it settles the long-standing additivity conjectures. Okay, so just to finish with some open questions, I think these have all been asked, stated before. Find useful bounds for the channel capacity CFE. Okay, it's because of non-additivity, the hollow-hole capacity, it's not equal to the hollow-hole capacity, so, okay, how much bigger is it? Here'd be a great one. Find a single letter formula for CFE instead of in something that replaces the hollow bulk capacity. So maybe someone can do that this afternoon. That'd be great. Settle the additivity question. That was raised. Graham posed that problem this morning. So that would be interesting. And Hastings then also has a conjecture, which is that phi tensor phi bar itself sort of you know, what it say, okay, so what the result says is that if you look at the minimum output entropy of phi tensor phi bar, then it wants to be an entangled state between those, okay? So Hastings' conjecture is that if you entangle those two, then it won't want to do anything else. So if you take multiple copies of phi tensor phi bar, then the minimal output entropy will be a product state over each of the factors of phi tensor phi bar. That would be interesting. So just to conclude, I think that Hastings' paper really introduces a lot of new ideas and a new way of looking at things, and I would guess that it will be useful for addressing these questions and perhaps other ones also. Okay, so thanks very much.